Chapter 10, What Goes Up Must Come Down. I spent the morning of August 26, 1883, or D-Day of the Month of Lamb in Krakatoa, as I had spent the morning before, swimming and sunbathing on that delightful little fine coral beach. After having had a day of light eating at the sea's Chinese restaurant, I attacked a Dutch breakfast at Mr. D's with gusto, a breakfast which included many cups of the richest, most delicious hot chocolate I have ever had the pleasure of drinking. I was afraid to go in swimming after such a huge meal, so I took a sunbath with my good friend Mr. F for an hour or so when we went to the beach. I was pleased to see that I was getting quite tan. I got my first real burn when I made my bizarre nude arrival on Krakatoa, added to it the day we flew in the balloon merry-go-round and considerably darkened it the morning before on the beach, so that I was fast losing my comparatively pale appearance, which so distinguished me at first from my fellow Krakatoans. Up to now, said Mr. F., as the movement of the earth's surface rolled him over near me, you have asked me many questions which I have done my best to answer. I think you now know just about all there is to know about life on the island. Now I'm going to ask you to tell me all you can think of in the way of news about my native city, San Francisco, a city from which you have just arrived and which I haven't seen in over 7 years. That's fair enough, I said. I then started to think of how best to do this. As a schoolteacher, I was pretty well tied down to a rather monotonous form of urban life, but I did get to know a lot of people. I conducted classes for children between the ages of 10 and 15, which was the ages of the children of the Krakatoan families. I reasoned, therefore, that the parents of the children I taught must have been the same age as Mr. F. I described San Francisco to him as a social columnist would, telling him about these people as if they were my closest friends, telling him what they were doing in terms of parties, minstrels, circuses, theaters, dinners, and whatever social functions I could remember having attended with any of them. This proved to be an excellent idea, for he had known some of the people I mentioned, and I had heard others talked about by friends of his on Krakatoa. I suppose one doesn't think of one's hometown in terms of streets and buildings as much as one does of personal associations, friends, and relatives. Whenever I mentioned a friend of his eyes lit up, and he started firing all sorts of questions at me. He was amazed at the many details, stories, and anecdotes I could tell about their children. "You must be very fond of children," he said. "You seem to take such a humorous and sympathetic attitude towards stories of their classroom tricks and pranks." I still had no intention of telling anybody on the island that I had been a schoolteacher, but, of course, in telling Mr. F. about his friends in San Francisco, I had clearer memories of their children, to whom I was subjected to every day, than of their parents, whose homes I only visited on rare and usually trying and formal occasions. "Yes," I said, gritting my teeth, "I've always been close to children." I continued mentioning more people Mr. F. knew and recounting as many incidents as I could recall about them. I must say Mr. F. was a good listener. He had been lying down flat on his back. He was now propped up on his elbows and seemed completely fascinated with my account. "Just a minute," he said. "I hate to interrupt you, but I have a wonderful idea. Everybody here is from San Francisco, and I'm sure they would get the same thrill hearing of their old friends and of their friends' family as I am getting now. Would you possibly consider giving us all a talk, just this one, in the dining room after lunch?" "I would be only too delighted," I said. "Wonderful," said Mr. F. "You can't imagine how much they'll like this. Our conversation here always seems eventually to get around to San Francisco, and we haven't had any real news of our old friends in years." We took a swim, let the sun dry us off, and returned to Mr. F.'s house. While I was dressing, Mr. F. ran around to all the houses preparing everybody for the talk I was going to give. I was very pleased that in this simple way I was perhaps going to be able to repay them somewhat for their fabulous hospitality. We had a delicious lunch, which consisted simply of huge portions of Javanese ristafel, which is Javanese rice cooked and curried, as the Dutch do it in the Dutch East Indies. Krakatoa is actually part of the Dutch East Indies, though no Dutchman has ever cared to set foot on the island. We had lots of this hot rice and huge glasses of wonderful cold Javanese tea. I was pretty hot from my freshly acquired sunburn. I was warm inside from this delicious hot curry, and after several stimulating glasses of tea, I had a nice warm feeling all over and was well prepared to give my talk. Mr. F. waited until all of the tables had been cleared by the D. family, then placed a chair on one of the tables. He silenced the crowd, introduced me as a speaker in a most informal and nice way, looked at me, and pointed to the chair. I climbed up on the table, sat down, and after the 20 families were all comfortably settled, began my talk. The response to it was amazing and most gratifying. Each time I mentioned a new name, at least one face in the audience would light up. There would be much nudging of elbows, smiles, and faraway, homesick looks. Giving this simple talk, which seemed to bring so much genuine pleasure to these people, was a tremendous joy to me. While I was talking, all eyes were attentively fixed on me, and I was looking around the room, catching the reactions of each new name I mentioned, and thinking up incidents to talk about next. Looking out of the window, I noticed that the ground seemed a little more active than usual. Being a new citizen of the island, I didn't know whether there was anything unusual about this at first. I went on with my talk. As I recall it, before being most rudely interrupted by a singularly sinister event, I had talked over 3 hours. I noticed that the earth was moving with increasing violence. I looked at my watch. The movement of the earth's surface usually subsided completely for a few minutes out of each hour, but that afternoon it had been getting increasingly violent over a period of 2 hours. This was quite alarming. I called this to the attention of the other people. They all turned and looked out of the windows. Some of them didn't seem at all alarmed, but others looked quite frightened. I was far from feeling at ease. Mr. M. walked over to the window and looked out. After a few minutes, he said, "I don't think it's anything to get much alarmed over. After all, most of our houses were knocked down in 77. "But they were simple huts," said Mr. T. "I know, but they had diamond foundations, too. This house hasn't shown any signs of the slightest vibration. Please go on with your talk, Professor Sherman." This seemed to reassure everyone considerably, though I can't say my heart was in my speech as much as before. I noticed that my audience was rather restless, too. Suddenly, this was a sight which is as vivid to me now as it was when I first saw it. The wall opposite me slowly and almost noiselessly opened up in a crack large enough to allow the sun to shine through. It was the most terrifying and sinister sight I have ever seen. A considerable amount of powdered plaster dropped on the heads of the families in the room, and the windows near the cracked wall broke open. The windows had all been closed so that the usual noise of the mountain wouldn't interfere with my talk. Now, through the crack in the wall and through the broken windows, the rumblings of the mountain thundered in full force. Mr. M. rushed to the table where I was sitting, leaped onto it, and immediately started shouting instructions. "I want all of the women and little children to run to the platform at once and start taking the covers off of the balloons. I want all of the men to run quickly to their houses and grab their family parachutes." Hearing the word parachute at that moment came to me like a blow on the head, and dashed to the balloon platform. "I want the 6 boys, who are 15 years old, to take whatever food Mrs. D. has prepared for tonight and rush it to the platform." He clapped his hands loudly, and the room was emptied at once. He turned to me and said, "We've rehearsed this 1,000 times. Don't be alarmed, Professor Sherman. I am confident that everything will turn out all right. We'll be off in less than 15 minutes. Now," he said, "you're the only man with no particular job at this time. We all have pretty large amounts of diamonds sewn into a pouch attached to our family parachutes. Why don't you take a bucket and see if you can get to the mines and grab some diamonds? A few big ones will take care of you quite nicely, but don't go near the mines if it's too dangerous. Please, Mr. Sherman, don't go near the mines if..." He was shouting after me, for I was off for the mines like a madman as soon as I got the gist of his suggestion. Unfortunately for me, this was a waste of time. It was impossible to approach the mountain. I knew I had just a little over 10 minutes' time, the time needed to fill the balloons. I tried running. The action of the earth's surface threw me to the ground. I tried walking. I doddered, staggered, floundered, and tumbled. I tried crawling, but the earth's rumblings and heavings kept rolling me over on my side. I looked up at the mountain ahead and saw at once that it would be impossible to reach in the short time allotted me. I threw away my bucket, turned, and ran through the village for the platform, reeling, buckling, and falling every few feet of the way. I was the last to see the village of Krakatoa from the ground. I was there in time to see the crystal Krakatoan house splinter and flatten to the ground in a great shower of broken glass. The M's Moroccan house, full of those amazing inventions, was burning like a huge plum pudding, due, no doubt, to a short circuit in the electric living room. When I arrived at the balloon platform, it was straining at the hoses, ready to leap. There were many hands extended my way. I reached up, and my arms were grabbed just as the balloon platform tore itself away. I was lifted onto the platform. I remember 20 pops like champagne corks in rapid succession as the rubber ball and socket connections were broken, and the 81 Krakatoans swiftly bounded off into the air. The first moments on the platform were bedlam. Some of the women were screaming. Some of the children were crying. The men were feverishly trying to connect the hoses to the hydrogen tank. And the boys who controlled the levers, allowing gas to enter the balloons, were shouting at the men to hurry up so they could level the platform. We were flying right at the mountain on an uncomfortable slant, and we weren't gaining altitude very fast. It required a certain amount of patience and a 150-pound push to snap the hose connections together. The men, in their frantic hurry, would grab an end of the hose, start pushing them together toward each other, and then slip and bang their heads. 3 minutes after our takeoff, everybody was shouting at once except me. I was afraid to interfere in this supposedly well-rehearsed maneuver for fear of receiving an excited, angry punch in the nose. The hoses were finally all connected in one of those desperate last-minute action moments of confusion. Every boy added gas to his balloon at once. Mr. M dumped the water used to insulate the hydrogen tank off the platform with a trip of a foot lever, and the giant platform rose just in time to clear the mountaintop. We flew directly over the crater. Here, instead of being sucked downward by the vacuum as we had been in the balloon merry-go-round when the mountain was calm, we were greeted by a roaring, swift, upward blast of hot air, which catapulted us far up into the sky. When we were about a half mile up, we were comparatively still. There might have been a little wind, but it wasn't strong enough to blow us off this hot, sulfurous air shaft. We were trapped on top of it, like those celluloid balls on upward streams of water in shooting galleries. Ladies and gentlemen, we spent the night, a horribly long, sleepless, broiling night, on top of this volcano. The heat of the air from the crater and the altitude to which we were lifted caused the hydrogen to dilate in the balloons until they looked ready to burst. It was impossible to consider adding more hydrogen to the balloons in an attempt to get high enough to get off this air shaft, and it would have been idiotic to let gas out of the balloons and thus lower ourselves nearer the inferno. The one relieving aspect of that miserable night was that the upper current of air kept the platform nice and level, though we swayed back and forth rather violently at times. The light from the blazing crater made everything up where we were bright red. This considerably intensified the heat. It was bad enough to be broiling without looking bright red, too. This was indeed an ironic state of affairs. It was the highest any of us had ever flown, and still, we each had the feeling that this was closer to a sensation of hell than anything we had ever experienced. I suppose, too, that our food was kept warm, though no one thought of eating anything that night. We spent 17 hours over the volcano, from 5 o'clock in the afternoon of the 26th until 10 o'clock the following morning. At that time, the shaft of hot air seemed to have lost its strength. We were lowered to an altitude of about 100 feet above the mountain, or roughly 1,500 feet above sea level, and there a wind cleared us of that dreadful crater. The boys busied themselves keeping the platform level again, and the men and women of Krakatoa gave longing looks at their island, believing that the eruptions had ceased and that they had been foolish to leave. I cannot say that I shared this feeling at all. There wasn't a house left standing, and I had no desire to return to this now desolate and fearful place, even if the diamond mines were intact. We flew until we were a mile over Java, when, with stunning suddenness, the island of Krakatoa, in 7 rapid, ear-splitting explosions, blew up straight into the air for as far as we could see. Our flying platform was rocked back and forth at 30-degree angles by the concussions. Those of us who were near the balustrade hung on for dear life. A few of those who were in the middle of the platform were tossed about like flapjacks in a skillet. We were 27 miles away from the island when it happened, which was just about far enough away for safety. Any closer and we would have been dumped right off the platform into the Sunda Strait. We couldn't see what was left of Krakatoa because it was wrapped in a thick, huge, tremendously tall black cloud of pumice, ashes, smoke, lava, dirt, with, I suppose, a few $1 billion worth of diamonds thrown in. We were fortunate in that the explosion was followed by a strong air current produced in the same manner as waves on the surface of a lake when a stone is thrown in. We were swiftly being taken away from the scene of the eruption. We were afraid that ashes, rocks, or even diamonds might fall on us and pierce our balloons, but all that actually happened was that nature was that we were soon enveloped by the thick black dust cloud, which was so dense that it was almost impossible to see through, making it extremely difficult to keep the platform level. We traveled with this cloud for hours, not being able to see whether ground or sea was beneath us, and fearing the horrible fate of crashing into a mountaintop in Java. We tied handkerchiefs around our faces so that we wouldn't breathe too much of the thick concentration of powdered ashes and pumice we were traveling with. And it seemed for a while that as long as the wind was with us, the powdered remains of Krakatoa would follow along, and that we would be forever enveloped in the ghost of a dead island. The wind generated by the explosion was tremendous, and for the entire duration of this extraordinary journey, we were hurtling through space at a fabulous speed. The food situation, now that I look back at it, was the funniest, I'm sure, in the history of life raft travel. We had three huge cauldrons of a Dutch dish Mrs. D had prepared for dinner the night of the eruption. This dish was called Stampot van Zuurkool met Rookwurst. We also had a huge jug of Van Houten's cocoa and a crate of Gouda cheeses. I've heard of shipwrecked men living for days on hardtack and water, but we citizens of the former island of Krakatoa lived on Stampot van Zuurkool met Rookwurst. This was a dish consisting of meat cooked in gravy, sauerkraut, and sausages. Mr. M., the man who first discovered the diamond mines of Krakatoa and who persuaded the 20 other families to go and live there, felt responsible for them all at this moment of crisis. He supervised the rationing of the food, allowing but meager portions of Stampot van Zuurkool met Rookwurst to each person and three swallows of cocoa with each meal. He also advised every family except one to jump off at the first sight of land, no matter what country it might be. "I have a good reason for this," he said. "Professor Sherman has no parachute. He will have to try and land the platform. It would be impossible and foolish for him to consider landing the platform on land. He will have to risk crashing it in some body of water. The family that volunteers to remain with him will help him control the balloons until water is sighted. They will then jump off, leaving the platform to Professor Sherman. I want every family except one to jump off as soon as possible so that as much food as can possibly be left over will be available to Professor Sherman, whose journey overland might take him many days. With this in mind, the crate of cheeses, which are less perishable than the rest of the food, will be left intact for him." I paid a considerable amount of attention to this speech of his, in which I seemed to be leading man and most unhappy actor of a forthcoming melodrama. Mr. M. then asked if any family wanted to volunteer to stay with me until the proper time was at hand for me to attempt a landing in the water. The S. volunteered immediately, which cheered me up a great deal. On the afternoon of the second day, the black cloud had thinned out sufficiently so that we could see that we were no longer flying over Java. I had since tried to reconstruct the voyage on the balloon platform, and I believe we were flying at that time over the Indian Ocean. On the afternoon of the third day, we sighted land, and 19 of the families gave forth with rousing cheers, embraced each other, and broke into happy dances. The F's ran to my side to comfort me, to show me that they had no intentions of leaving me until they had seen me safely to another body of water. We were soon no longer over water, but flying over thickly vegetated jungles. Mr. M. was leaning intently over the balustrade, studying the nature of the country. He pointed out teakwood trees and sandalwood trees, and observed the redness of the earth. "This is India," he said. The 19 families happily started readying their family parachutes. These were well designed. I shall describe them as best I can. There was a square silk sheet stretched out by two stout bamboo poles, crossed diagonally from corner to corner. At each corner of the sheet was a parachute, and from each of these hung two straps attached to a belt harness. Each member of a family put on one of these belt harnesses, and when they jumped, mother, father, and the two children all descended together with the bamboo poles, keeping them far enough apart so there was no danger of their bumping into each other in midair. The families were all anxiously looking out for a nice spot to land in. At first, we flew over nothing but dense jungle life. Then we sighted a few small villages. Mr. M. advised everybody to avoid coming down in a village because the natives might not know what to make of parachutes. They waited until they saw a proper spot in the distance, which was a rather soft-looking plateau, said goodbye to the F's and me, and earnestly wishing us the best of luck, when all jumped at once so as to be together after they landed. The balloon platform lunged into the air when relieved of this weight, and Mr. F and Mrs. F, F1 and F2, and I continued on a dreadful 9 more days, which took us across India, Persia, Turkey, Hungary, Austria, Germany, Belgium, where Mr. F's family finally left me, and took me on alone over England until I was at last able to crash the platform into the Atlantic. We had warm August and September weather and a magnificent wind, but except for the Dardanelles, which were too narrow to land in, we traveled clear across Europe, missing every body of water. We missed the Caspian Sea, the Black Sea, and the Mediterranean. The five of us spent 9 miserable days together, living mostly on cheese, rummaging through our barrels of food like dogs in garbage cans, separating the spoiled food from the good, drinking rationed amounts of sauerkraut juices and stale cocoa, sleeping uncomfortably in 4-hour shifts, and running around from balloon to balloon, keeping the platform level until we thought we dropped dead from exhaustion. On the 9th day, we were over Belgium, and we sighted the English Channel. I said goodbye to my friends, the F's, and helped them fix up their parachute. I sadly watched them as they dropped slowly to the earth below, then started to attempt to land the platform. In order to get at the valves which released the hydrogen from the balloons, I had to break the hose connections with which they were attached to the tank. This, as you will recall, required a 150-pound pull. I realized when I started to pull one apart that I didn't have enough strength left in me to do this fast enough to be able to land the platform in the channel. I was afraid that the distance required to land the platform smoothly would take me clear across and I'd crash into the shores of England. So, tired as I was, I resolved to spend the afternoon flying over England. At 7 o'clock at night, flying over Scotland, I sighted the Atlantic Ocean and started a tug of war with each hose until I got all of the connections apart. Then I started to descend. My trip ended in a 2-hour uphill run. Every time I let the gas out of one side of the platform, I'd have to run up the platform to the high side and let the gas out of that, then run back uphill to the other side from end to end, across the back, to and fro on a perpetual incline until I finally crashed into the Atlantic. I kept being reminded of a vaudeville act I had once seen in the London Music Hall. A Negro clown dressed like a porter in a railroad station played God Save the King, running back and forth on the stage with hammers striking the ties of the railroad tracks. One tune on this giant xylophone of his, and he flopped on the stage exhausted as the audience rocked with laughter. I assure you, I must have been awfully close to death when Captain Simon of the SS Cunningham sighted me and picked me up 20 minutes after my crash. The rest of my story you know, I believe. If you have any questions, I'll gladly try to answer them. The huge audience rose as one and acclaimed Professor Sherman with thunderous cheers and applause. After 10 minutes of this hubbub, the mayor, who had been wildly shaking the professor's hand and patting him on the back, walked upstage and held up his hands to quiet the audience. "Have you any questions?" he asked. There was a silent pause. Then a man in the audience shouted, "How were you able to give us such a wonderful talk in your sickened condition, Professor Sherman?" "Ha ha!" shouted the professor, leaping out of bed. "I feel fine. I rested up completely on the presidential train on my 5-day trip across the country. I could have made the talk standing up, but when I saw this beautiful bed on the speaker's platform, I thought I'd be a stupid fool if I passed it up." The crowd laughed loudly at this, clapped its approval. Then a woman stood up. "What are you going to do now, Professor?" she yelled. With a broad grin on his face, Professor William Waterman Sherman rolled up his coat sleeve and showed his shirt cuffs. His diamond cufflinks blazed and twinkled as they reflected the many rays from the footlights. "I have here a pair of diamond cufflinks made simply of four diamonds the size of lima beans. They were given to me by my good friend Mr. F. the first day I landed on Krakatoa. I am going to first sell these cufflinks, then build myself a balloon, which I shall christen the Globe the Second. I shall attach to this balloon a basket house and a seagull catcher on which I am now working. Using food for ballast, I plan to spend one full year in the air, 1 year of truly delightful living, a year in a balloon."
This was a presentation of William Penn Dubois' The 21 Balloons.